of those, that'd be great, Gina, thanks. Okay, there you go. Well, thank you for letting me come today. And so I hope I don't overwhelm you with information. It's sort of exciting to be able to come here and talk to you all today. Just let me hand you out. I have this fact sheet out about the Social Services Association last week. I'm going to cover more than just hunger and food security. I talked to some of my fellow advocates over the last couple of days, and they also sent me some information that they are concerned about. So, just a broad overview of poverty in Utah for the as you can see, children and women are far more likely to experience poverty than men. Working age men only experience poverty at 9.8%, and both women and children, particularly working age women, over 12% in both of those categories. And as you all well know, the gender wage gap is, Utah has one of the highest gender wage gaps in the country, which always obviously makes it much more difficult for female moms, for women who don't have children, to make ends meet. And when we're talking about hunger and food insecurity basically is the inability for a family to have, they lack the resources to buy enough food. And in Utah, we're really pretty much in line with the rest of the nation. Percentage of Utah households who experience food insecurity, 1 in 8. And when you look at households with children, usually who are headed by a single parent, who usually is a mom, it's 1 in 6. And when you look at the metropolitan statistical areas, I mean, really just sort of captures our big urban areas. Those numbers jump, particularly in Ogden and in Salt Lake, 1 in 5 households with children experience hunger and food insecurity. So SNAP, which is a Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or what was formerly known as food stamps, is really our first line of defense against hunger, and it really is the most comprehensive way for us to address hunger in our country. In fact, until the Reagan administration, when deep cuts started happening to those safety net programs, we had nearly eliminated hunger and food insecurity in our country, and that was primarily because of federal nutrition programs, programs like SNAP, programs like school breakfast, WIC, senior congregate meals, comprehensive programs that really serve the most vulnerable in our community. And as you can see, there are not 82,900. Is that the right number? Oh, for some reason, I saw an extra number on there. About 83,000 households access SNAP. 37% of those are headed by a single parent. And again, those are generally women. The average household size is a little larger than the national average, about 2.5. Only about 7% of Utah households receive SNAP, which is well below the national average of 9%. Only 74% of participating households are of eligible households participate. So we have a lot of work to do. We could do a lot more work in reaching those households they need. And I think really where the gap is the biggest is in elderly households and disabled households. We have a very low participation rate among elderly households. The percentage of working poor households, meaning that those folks that we would expect to be working, only 66% of those households access now. And then 61% of non-elderly SNAP participants are women, and 64% of elderly adults who receive SNAP are women.
Yeah, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Okay.
So you mentioned there is a big gap in terms of participation of disabled and elderly.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think that that has to do with the fact that there are other options like Meals on Wheels and Convert Get Meals at senior centers? Or am I misunderstanding your data there?
No, I'm not fewer elderly. Are you saying there are fewer elderly folks that participate in SNAP? We have fewer elderly people 60 and older who participate in SNAP. I think it's a number of factors. I think that they're less likely to want to access government programs when we talk to elderly folks. I mean, and this is really, you know, I mean, 60 is hardly elderly. You know, I know, the closer I get, the younger it seems, that they're less likely to access SNAP. And it used to be that elderly households thought that they had to purchase their SNAP benefits, which used to be the case in the late 60s, early 70s. But they often worry that if they access the program, that other people won't be able to. And so needing to explain to them that it's an entitlement program, that as long as you meet the criteria, you're eligible. I think there's just a reluctance to rely on government resources. But honestly, I think one of the biggest challenges, and this would go for households with disabilities, it would go for refugee and non-English-speaking households, is that while we have a really efficient model for people to access SNAP, it often prevents people who are most vulnerable from accessing it. The vast majority of people apply online, they do a phone interview, and so if you are elderly and homebound, how do you access the internet, and how do organizations like Usan Against Hunger or Jewish Family Services or Comunidad de Familias, how do they find those folks in those, you know, who are homebound? How do we connect with those households to find out what they need and to help them apply for benefits? And so they, I think part of it is that they lack access to.
Thank you. Beyond this, you mentioned the Utah gender-based gap, that we are the highest in the nation for. And the only reason I'm asking that is because we will be discussing the gender-based race discrimination, and I'm just curious, what did you get your data?
Oh, I got this from, and I can certainly send you the link. It's a national organization that puts out statistical information about the demographics of states that goes from, you know, poverty and food insecurity to access to after school child care. It's toppoverty.org, and they have state statutes. So I didn't look at where they got their data, but we use their information a lot. I'm not sure. Okay, so what's at stake? So this is the stuff that keeps me up at night. The federal concerns, obviously, right now, the budget is our greatest concern, both the White House budget and the House budget. You know, we've always been sort of reassured that, you know, no matter how balanced the White House budget was, it was pretty much dead on arrival. But, you know, it was sort of the White House statement of what their funding priorities are. And I think what we're looking at this year, and when you do a comparison, that's just not the case this time. And I want to call particular attention to, I hope that you can, this isn't too long for you to read, but it's kind of hard for me to look at, is that it includes deep and largely unspecified cuts in entitlement programs, and lacks detail on the policies, and, you know, really hiding what the real impacts are. And then the end result is that it's going to increase poverty, food insecurity, access to all sorts of programs. It increases inequality, and really weakens the investments that federal programs make in families so that they can succeed. And the biggest concern that we have is that it shifts costs to states.
Right.
saying that that's our that's the nexus of why we wanted to have this conversation.
Yeah, and you know, really think of all of the program cuts across the board, and I think it's a sneaky way for Congress to bypass some responsibility in saying we're going to cut this program, we're not going to specify it. They push either the funding through block grants down to the states, and the state legislators become the bad guys, start deciding who is going to get funding for which programs. So the programs that we pay attention to, specifically SNAP, the House Budget Resolution calls for $10 billion in cuts over 10 years. There's no detail. I mean, there's no information in some of the budget documents, and it's largely around work requirements and giving more flexibility to the state. And to be clear, there are already work requirements in the SNAP program. Now, there are some really great provisions for exemptions. Women, people who are taking care of children under the age of 6 are exempt from the work requirement. If you are the sole provider of a parent. So there are some provisions that allow the parents to stay home or to receive extension time taking care of their kids. Otherwise, you are required to be participating. One of the most vulnerable populations for disabled-bodied adults without dependents, again, able-bodied is a subjective thing for states. There are some federal exemptions. 64% of those women who are ABOs are women. And these are a lot of the women that we're seeing around the Rio Grande, are women who face not only health challenges, employment challenges. They can get a job, but they can't keep a job. So we don't know a lot about this population, and I think it's one of the things that if the Department of Workforce Services had more funding to specifically focus on the ABUS population, we would know a lot more about those folks, and I think that we could help them get better and more employment. There's also recommended an additional $150 billion, in SNAP that will likely come through the Farm Bill, which expires in September, but we suspect is that they will do continuing resolution of the current Farm Bill, and then when they start taking up the Farm Bill, there will be $150 billion in cuts. They achieve that largely through, again, enforcing the work requirements, and in states to enforce the work requirements, they need additional funding to really make those activities meaningful. I think that there are other states who do a better job on those employment activities. But I think in a lot of ways that they just become sort of checking off the boxes. They're not meaningful things that really help people get work because they don't have caseworkers that are working in addition to people. They have an online curriculum, which is great for people who can do that. But if you don't have access to a computer, if you don't know how to use a computer, if that intimidates you, if you're at a public computer, there are all sorts of barriers that prevent people from participating in those work activities and really understanding what the parameters of those work activities are. It also means that they are looking to block grant the boot camp program, which is, people in those states and often will love the flexibility of having a block grant. Our biggest concern is that we remove federal protections and states can then decide who deserves to receive benefits and who doesn't. And we saw that 20 plus years ago in Canada. And fast forward 20 years, the intent of the Canada Block Grant that funds our family employment program was to connect mostly single moms to the workforce and to provide them a financial grant that would allow them to have some income while they were working on an employment grant. We haven't had, there's been an $82 increase in benefits for that cash grant in 20 years, so it has not kept pace with demand. with all of our work on intergenerational poverty, you would think that that would be one of the chief priorities. If we have families and moms who are working to become employable to move their families out of poverty, we should give them a real cash benefit that prevents them from sliding deeper into poverty. We only spend 24% of our CANA grant on cash assistance because the state has so much flexibility. It is being spent on incredibly worthy projects. But there now is not enough funding available in our CANA grant to do a grant increase. So imagine if that we spend about $20, $25 million a month in food stamps in the state. Imagine if only 25% of those benefits were going for the ability for families to purchase food. That would be devastating. And the other part of how we're going to achieve those savings is by pushing some of those costs down to the state. So it would basically become a maintenance of effort, a 20% maintenance of effort, which in our case would be $60 million a year. I mean, I can't even say that with a straight face. Because can you imagine Department of Workforce Services going to Social Services Appropriations and asking for $60 million to be able to meet our maintenance of effort? Then you start saying, okay, well then so who can we cut off of who's currently eligible for SNAP in order to get that amount of money down to a manageable size? And so it's a very disconcerting scenario for us, so we're deeply concerned about that. Cuts to child nutrition programs. There is a provision that is currently being implemented called the community eligibility provision that allows schools that have 40% of their kids who are getting lunch at free or reduced price to use that formula to allow the school districts or allow that school to serve those meals to all kids for free. And so there is a proposal to increase that amount from 40% of children who are receiving meals at free or reduced price to 60%. And that would eliminate tens of thousands of children, about 22,000 children, from being able to have access to free and reduced price. So some of the additional federal budget cuts that we're concerned about. Housing, proposed House budget cuts 140,000 housing vouchers, which would be about 680 per default. Given our current circumstances with housing and the availability and the tight housing market, not just along the Wasatch Front, but in other parts of the state, that would obviously increase homelessness. After school programming, there is the cut to the 21st century after school programs. It would cut about $1 million, impacting 1,000 students and their families. And then additional job, I know I could spend my entire time talking about the federal budget, the job training and employment, which we know, I mean, we already have so few options for families to go into job training and employment. I mean, that's something that has been cut over the years. Pell Grants, family planning, and mental health. So all of those impacted a family's ability to be successful. So now on to the state priorities. This is it's a long list. I don't think anything on here will probably surprise you. And like I mentioned before, any of the proposed cuts that are happening on the federal level that just get pushed down to the state, those needs are still there, and I think it will just deepen the disparities and widen the gap between families who have the means to make it and those who don't. And so it basically falls down to I have a better slide than this, I'm sorry. There are about four areas. So access to health care, and again, none of this is surprising to any of you. Access to affordable health care, access to mental and physical health care. And really, we want folks to be able to be healthy. The healthier they are, the more successful they can be. How can you go out and get a job and improve in your employment if you are battling healthcare issues. And then reproductive healthcare. Almost everybody that I reached out to in the healthcare community should have reproductive healthcare. Financial disability and work support, which is probably the broadest category. Increased funding to individual development accounts. I don't know how many of you know Martha Wonderly from AAA Fair Credit. And women are the financial decision makers in the household. The more ability they have to invest and to get some return on that and to improve financial decisions for the family, the better off they'll be. For living wages, we know there's a lot of interest in that. One of the things that I previewed a book a friend of mine wrote, and this was something I didn't know. If nationally we raise the federal minimum wage to $10.10, that would reduce the food stamp cash flow by 20%. Just those investments up front and really making work pay really helps families succeed. And for us, be able to move off of those public assistance programs. Nobody really wants to have to rely on those programs to make, to make ends meet. I will get you the exact amount. I just printed the paper yesterday. If you raise it to $10.10, it would reduce, and this is the part I'm not as confident about, it would reduce the future case load by 20%.
Okay.
But
if you can get that,
I will absolutely do that. Yeah, I will. Of course, affordable, accessible after school programs, child care. I mean, we're, if you've ever had a kid in daycare, if you've ever had a kid in after school, my son's after school, he's 23 now, he's not in after school. But when he was, having access to quality after school programming is what made our life work. I did not have to worry about that he was safe, that he was in an enriched, enriching environment, and it was what made being able to do my job. I did drive him along to plenty of legislative meetings, but, having him somewhere where I knew that he had friends, that there were adults who cared about him, who cared about, his behavior and getting his homework done, it saved us. And, I think every parent deserves to have that confidence and that security knowing your kids are okay. Affordable housing, and again, this comes up again and again and again, that working families need to have access to affordable housing. That it just isn't about, building shelters, which is not a criticism of what we're doing around the homelessness, but we also have to invest in affordable housing so that families can live in the communities where they work. Again, access to education and job training. Only 2% of parents who are actually in the family employment program are enrolled in education and training. And about 33% of those women don't have a GED. Why isn't that our number one priority? To make sure we're investing in those young women to make sure that they have more employment opportunities. Increased access to food, funding and support for farm to school, which connects school districts and schools to the local agriculture. It's a complicated issue. There's a lot of moving parts in farm to school. Salt Lake County has a project that they're working on to try and address some of those barriers. One of the projects,
I have a question.
Sure.
Is it Commissioner Burkholder?
Yes, thank you.
Hello.
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to ask you about the housing wage on the prior slide, because you talked both about living wages and affordable housing being something that is simpler for homeless people. There is a national study that's done every year called Out of Reach.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the 2017 publication, I believe that for Salt Lake County, and they do this for all of the counties in Utah, Salt Lake County, I believe that a two-bedroom apartment requires between $17 and $18
an hour.
So I think that when we're talking about increase in floor base wages for people in our state, it is more compelling to talk about housing wages. Because none of us are meant to be spending more than 30% of our income on housing. And so that is part of what keeps people out of housing, and also when they are in housing, keeps them from being able to do other things with their income. So I think that information from the national level, which comes out every year, and I may be wrong about that. So
no,
I may not be between 17 and 18, but
no, I'm sure
that I
know
for what you're right.
Right.
I think you're
right, and housing certainly is not, you know, I was peripherally familiar with it, but I don't know that, yeah, I think you're right, it's between 17 and 18. I mean, just for example, there's some low-income housing building next to my house, and there are 12 units. They are not, I wouldn't let my son live there. And they're $1,400. I mean, these three-bedroom apartments have two tiny, tiny bedrooms, and just not, and they're, you know, they're very shoddy apartments. And so, yeah, I mean, I know the families who live there, they're, a lot of them are leaving the shelter, a lot of them are in transition, but you know, thank goodness for housing support, because there's no way they could afford to pay that amount, but their vouchers are worth $1,400. State funding for Double Up Food Bucks. Double Up Food Bucks is a program that allows folks who are using their EBT card, their SNAP card, at farmers markets. They can match up to $10 per market day. So you get out to the downtown farmer market, they use their food stamp benefits, they get an additional $10 in benefits to buy fruits and vegetables. So it's a way of increasing those households, the resources to buy food. Right now, in Utah, the average benefit is about $1.28 per person per meal. So it really boosts the buying ability of those families during the market season. It not only does it help those families purchase more fruits and vegetables, but it also supports local agriculture. So that would be a really interesting way for our state to support families. It would, right now we're spending about $50,000 a year on that program. It would be an investment well worth it. For every dollar that you spend in food stamp benefits, that generates about $1.74 in economic activity, which is better than nearly any other government action. Yes.
Tina, so where is the funding coming from right now? Is it state funding is here? Are you suggesting we increase that, or where does that come from?
So currently, Utah Youth Hunger got a grant 3 years ago from the federal government through the Food Insecurity Nutrition Incentive Grant. It was a 2-year grant, and we were able to extend it for an additional year. We have had support from the Department of Workforce Services through some indirect funding through InKind, and also in just working with them as an outreach partner. IHC has supported it. We've gotten support from Salt Lake City, from Allied Aid, from GE, which is no longer around. So it's a really great example of a private partnership. This was Utah Against Hunger's last season to launch the program. What we're hoping is that the Department of Health will take that over. There's a lot of interest there, and through their cancer awareness, if Canva, you can make that funding source. And one of the goals of that funding is to increase fruit and vegetable consumption. So we're hoping that we're starting early enough that we'll be able to transition that program to, you know, to another entity. It is a really, it's so easy. I mean, it's just, you know, you go to a farmer's market, you see these little kids, and their moms give them a little green token, and, you know, you can buy something with it. It's a great program. I'm proud that you found some kind of involved with it.
The other one is called an environment, and it's, you know, again, not any surprise, meaningful legislation to address air quality issues. Low-income folks who have less access to health care, who often have more chronic health conditions, are disproportionately impacted by air quality.
Because the farmers market, you know, is in my district, but I was actually up in Logan this last weekend, mm-hmm. and they have a farmers market there too. So is the word getting out to some of the outlying areas that also have farmers
markets? So we have had double up food bucks at 28 farmers markets for 3 years. So I mean, there are markets that have been taking EBT cards, SNAP benefits, for a long time. Of the 28 that accept EBT, Utah Finish Hunger has actually funded those programs or those markets with program or with equipment grandfather. And so when we started this 3 years ago, I think we were in this unique position because we already had relationships with, you know, with markets statewide. So that right now there are 28 farmers markets who accept double up food vets, and there are a few more who also accept EBT.
Are you able to gather data? So, like, for example, if we were having conversations with our colleagues who represent Cass County, mm-hmm. for us to be able to say, you know, at your farmer's market, this many people from that Cass County area, your constituents, take advantage of this program.
Yes. We'll have, after this market season, we'll have 3 years of data. What is it, 2017? Prior to 2014, EBT data by market was a little sketchy because there was no mechanism really to require people to report. That was one of the good things with that double up business is that those participating markets are required to report to us. So we've got really good data about participation in each market.
I think that'll be really helpful to help allay some myths that we often hear. They're talking about people that buy certain type of foods with their food stamps and say, no, this is what this really looks like. And
right.
Yeah, that's a good recipe.
We have the conversation of cannabis and food stamps during executive appropriations. Why the uphill battle is going to be in there. You know, we do have an investigative team taking care of fraud on food stamps, even though the fraud is minimal.
Less than 9%.
Less than 1%, but it's a big deal for my colleagues, because, you know, they feel very compelled that they may be cashing these food stamps. And so, I mean, what was nice is they were able to explain what we currently do as a state to prevent fraud. And, you know, the red flags if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we need to keep that conversation moving forward that there's less than 1%. That is, you know, it's not the practice. It's like there is already, I think, a stigma that we have to deal with. And they, you know, whether they're using it to buy alcohol or, you know, alcohol cigarette thing a year, whatever. I don't know about they can find it anyways. We can't film anymore, but you know, it's real, and we have to be conscious that the struggles on funding may be one of the many problems we have to deal with. So, you know, you see this attitude of, oh, well, then how do they test this and how do they do this? And, you know, the fact that, or whatever, I don't know, like Spider would explain that, you know, they, for example, anytime you see patterns of, you know, zeros, on the transactions, you know, that's when have you ever paid $10, you know, you usually pay with cents. I mean, you know, there's some stuff that they are doing, but it happened on social services appropriations and it happened at regular appropriations, meaning this is an ongoing conversation that even if we already know here as a common knowledge that fraud is minimal, for some of our colleagues that may not be the case, and we need to be conscious that we need to do more education.
And I think acknowledging that those things do happen. I mean, I have been approached by, I remember this old guy in the Smiths, you know, he was with his shopping attendant, and came and asked me if I would buy him some toilet paper and, you know, some, I think, deodorant and soap or something like that, that he would buy some of my food. And he was like, I think I'm kind of like, I will be happy that I eat those things, but you can't, you just reach out to eat that. I think we have to acknowledge that those things do happen. I think the level of nefariousness, though, I think is what, where I think it's misguided. I mean, to say, you know, if I were to sit here and say that fraud doesn't happen, that would not be true, and it wouldn't be honest. But I think that the reasons why people commit fraud are not always to buy their insurance or to, you know, to buy drugs or things like that. I mean, generally speaking, it's to meet other needs, and it's, you know, that's one of the things in the food stamp program. You can only buy food. You can't buy tampons, you can't buy diapers, you can't buy soap, you can't buy toothpaste. And I was reading a report, one of the number one things that is the most shoplifted are feminine hygiene products.
They're so expensive.
If you go to an emergency food pantry and you need tampons, you'll get three. I think we all know that that's not a sufficient number of tampons for your period. I mean, it really is, you know, it's making a choice between, you know, buying an extra loaf of bread and, you know, other things. And so it's a complicated issue, and one of the things that really aggravates me is how folks on the low end of the income scale, that we are willing to make the worst assumptions about them and the reasons why they either bend rules or work, you know, do work around, when we don't have that same scrutiny for folks on the other end of the scale. Because people are going to do workarounds. They just are. That's how, you know, human nature, if you can see a loophole, you're going to try and get through it. And that's true of low-income folks, and it's true of higher-income folks. But yes, and you know, and I would love some advice or some feedback from you all and how we do something to come to educate legislators. You know, what information can we convey to them that will be compelling? And, you know, I think talking about the anti-fraud measures that Utah has in place, that the USDA has in place, I think that those, you know, I think that those are reassuring. But, you know, I think if they could meet, or if they understood, 71% of people who receive SNAP benefits are either under the age of 17, over the age of 60, or have a disability. I mean, the number of people that we would expect to work is a small minority of all of those who are receiving benefits. But there are a lot of misconceptions about some benefits from the SNAP program. And then the final thing that I want to talk about is the role that you all have played in our advocacy. That, you know, I'm one of the usual suspects. You know, they're legislators, you know, you just see them trying not to roll their eyes, right? It's kind of like, oh, we're dead girl, we're going to talk about hunger again. And you know, and I think we have a pretty friendly media environment for these issues. You know, the other news, the Public Tribune, TV stations, our NPR stations, they give us good coverage, and I think that they cover the issues fairly. But again, we're sort of the usual suspects. To have voices outside of the advocacy community taking positions on these issues, people you know, and for those of you who are elected officials, working with your colleagues to talk to them about these issues, asking your constituents to make phone calls or to make visits to their members of Congress, coming with us, any of you coming with us to congressional visits or to editorial board visits, writing letters yourself, I think that there's a real opportunity for there to be some, you know, some collaboration between the advocacy community and those of you who are working on each other's issues. And, you know, as you talk to women, you know, if you have constituents who have experience with the FINCH program, they're a voice that we deeply need in this conversation. That those who are most impacted. There's a young woman that I talked to a couple of weeks ago. I had been out for a week after my mom passed away, and it's Monday morning, and the phone rings. I was the first one in the office, and I answered the phone, and it was this young woman. So, yeah, I think I might need to be, I think I need to go to welfare. My arms nearly fell out of my head. I rolled my eyes. And then come to find out that she was this young 20-year-old woman who had custody of her 4 and 11-year-old sisters. That is who this program serves. And 78-year-old Maureen, who was forced to retire at 72 because she had lupus. And making sure that those are the folks that are protecting. We have to have a program that doesn't punish the few people who are going to have a workaround and make sure that we have programs that serve people who are the most vulnerable, who are doing the right thing, who are playing by the rules. I'm so sorry. We're playing by the rules. I mean, those are the people that these programs protect. And having your help in doing that, I think would make us more effective in our advocacy. So if you want to contact me, there's my contact information. I'm going to call it you for that. Do you have any other questions?
Any questions? Gina, the only thing that I would, this was such a helpful thing, and I want to thank Commissioner Friedman for suggesting that we have you come and visit with us. I think going forward, as we approach September, and we have a better idea of which of these steps we are likely to face, as soon as there could be an analysis, and I mean, we'll work with DWS too, but it's also great to hear from the advocates that are kind of keeping an eye on their specific bailiwick, wherever that is, within these myriad opportunities for cuts and challenges. But I think what's going to be helpful for us is to be able to approach this as a commissioner, say, if these cut cuts occur, then the state impact for us to be able to provide those services to our state constituency is X million dollars. And we want to be able to do that, you know, in September, or whenever we look, as soon as we see what things are, yeah, because our next meeting is going to be in October, so that'll be after the budget is issued. I'm thinking there may just be a continuing resolution to keep these things moving forward, but we just don't know what's going to happen. So we're trying to be nimble in terms of staying ahead of it, and so that we can guide the discussion for those of us that are in the legislature, for our colleagues, but then with the broader public, of talking about how we cannot work towards family prosperity when the ladies get cut out from underneath us this way. And that there's a state cost, but that just not these things are going to disappear, that there will be a state cost for us for picking up the load. And, you know, so this continued conversation, and as you see those numbers, letting us know what those are all, because then we can cascade that out, or, as you mentioned, the mechanisms where we could be the voice piece for that.
Yes, we will keep you apprised as soon as we have information. And you told Judith Chunger going to do a food stamp challenge, which is you challenge elected officials and the public to live on a food stamp budget for a week. That is going to start on Friday, September 15th, and go through September 21st. So we'll be sure to get an invitation.
Yes, let us know.
And if you have any ways, any of our congressional delegation, we've issued this challenge before and have yet to have any of them take it. So okay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gina. Any other questions before she leaves?
All right, super.
Thanks so much for this information. And will you send this PowerPoint to Shelley so that we can get that? She'll send that to all of us. Yeah. I'd like to have that handy.
Great. Thank you
so much. All right, one thing that we need to do before we go to our next presenter is to approve our minutes of our last meeting. Are there any comments on minutes or changes, or they look great and accurate to me? Seeing none, do we have a motion on the minutes? Mr. Friedman, thank you for the motion. Any discussion? No. And second. Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Great. Unanimously approved. And we will now welcome Tracy Gruber from the Department of Workforce Services. And looks like you were up. You have your presentation was up and then it was gone. But we are going to hear, there we go. Okay. a report on intergenerational poverty, and thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Members of the commission, I apologize for being late, and I appreciate switching just the agenda to accommodate me.
No problem.
I've been asked to come in and provide an update on the state's intergenerational poverty initiative. There has been a lot going on in the last year, and I'm going to focus on the Welfare Reform Commission's efforts to engage rural counties into urban counties to develop plans to address intergenerational poverty throughout the state. And I do have a PowerPoint, but I first just want to show you the intergenerational poverty website that's up and guide you to a new link. Well, it's been out for about 8 months, 9 months maybe, that aligns with our efforts around the county's intergenerational poverty plan development. We released some data, disaggregated by county, involving intergenerational poverty, so that the counties that are working on this initiative have a lot of data that they need to inform their planning. And this is available online. It's up for every county, not just 13 counties that have been working on the effort. And as you can see, just by looking at the Salt Lake County, you all see it on the screen, that we have a summary page, which provides kind of the overview data, the high-level data on intergenerational poverty in those counties. We also have a tab for education that has all of the schools throughout the county. Of course, Salt Lake County is very large, so there's lots of schools listed. That gives the percent of students enrolled who are meeting the definition of intergenerational poverty, their rates of chronic absence, and the percent of them that are receiving public assistance. Then we have a family economic stability tab that provides data by county of the economic stability indicators that we are looking at. From educational attainment levels of the adults to their wage in the past year, along with some county-level data on affordable housing. We are looking at what percentage of adults who are participating in SNAP, what percent of their income is going to housing, so we have that data on here as well. And then we have a tab for health. And I just think that data is critical and foundational for the state's intergenerational poverty effort, which is very clearly required that data and research guide the plans that are going on throughout the state. And now the tricky part is me getting back up my PowerPoint. Oh, there it is. Are there any questions on that data?
No, it was just the dental data always just breaks my heart. I can't believe that that's where we're at in a not a developed country and in a industrial country where we're still, it just breaks my heart.
And I think, if for those of you who've looked at the annual report, what we focus on in the area of health is that access is pretty high. The percentage of children who have access to public health insurance is significant. The percentage access for the parents is increasing. It's still not high enough, but it's increasing. And where we're seeing challenges is in the utilization. We just are not seeing that kids are going to the doctor frequently enough. They're absolutely not going to the dentist frequently enough. And it invites analysis of why that might be the case. I think for dental, it's pretty clear. There are a lot of dental providers throughout the state who are accepting Medicaid for children. For the healthcare issues, it's probably not as clear, except if you're looking at behavioral health. So we focus a lot with our partner at the Department of Health, the commission agency at the Department of Health, to try and figure out why, if they've got healthcare coverage, why is the utilization lower? And we anticipate that utilization will increase as parents get health insurance. That's what research tells us. That as parents increase their access to health insurance, they're more likely to bring their kids to the doctor. And we're seeing a little bit of an increase in utilization. But dental is a huge challenge. It's particularly a challenge for the adults. And we know that dental care has a significant impact on overall health, ability to get a job, ability to show up for work and show up for school. So it is an area of concern for sure. As I mentioned, the bulk of the effort in the last year of the Welfare Reform Commission, I will say, it was a very busy year for the commission. They released a revised 5- and 10-year plan that actually included recommendations for the first term in each of the areas of child well-being. That came out in January. It was a little late for the legislative session, but it's still in place. So the commission is hopeful that people will look at that plan and focus efforts around strategies that align with the data and the research. It's not designed to be a comprehensive list. There's always more, and as long as policies align with the data and the research, then the commission evaluates that every start of the legislative session and determines whether or not it aligns with those goals. So they released a new 5- and 10-year plan with strategies with a defined set of indicators, and those indicators will be reported on annually for the annual report. And we're really excited that for the first year we'll have a scorecard online for each of those areas of child well-being looking at those indicators. So the big effort was around engaging the counties, recognizing that they know their populations best and that solutions are really going to evolve at the local level. Of course, there's things that the state can do, but where the rubber meets the road is really at those counties. So about a year ago, 13 counties, 11 of which are rural with the highest rates of intergenerational poverty as a percentage of their child population, were invited to participate in a planning process. We had two counties, Weber and Utah. Weber does meet that threshold of high rates of intergenerational children experiencing intergenerational poverty, but Utah did not. But they were both very motivated counties, so they were also participating in this because of their motivation. And in conjunction with the commission, the Department of Workforce Services provided training modules to all of the counties to help them design a plan that was due to the commission by June 2nd. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about what has come out in those plans. It was an extremely exciting process. They all learned a lot. It's not the end of the road for them, and there's an incredible amount of attention on ensuring that those plans actually get implemented, and that's kind of the next phase in this effort. So this first slide is just a word cloud of what we saw, the common themes that we saw in the strategies. And you can see that there's behavioral health and mentoring, children, issues around literacy, education, of course. It's just a fun way to see where everybody was kind of working. They were required to focus on the strategies, to provide some information about the strategies that they want to implement. They were encouraged not to take a bite out of every area of child well-being that is part of the effort. And just as a reminder, we have four domains of child well-being. Those four domains are based on research that shows if you address those domains in a child's life in a positive way, that they are more likely to be successful into adulthood. So we've got early childhood development, education, family economic stability, and health. And for some of these counties, addressing all four of those areas is a bit more than they probably need to be focused on. So some of them only address the area, you know, one or two of those domains. The bigger counties, Weber and Utah, and Washington County, address all four of those areas of child well-being. They felt that they had the resources, the capacity, and the infrastructure to deal with all of those areas. So I think the biggest domains that we saw needing attention were education and health. And in the area of health, it was really around behavioral health. So this common strategy slide just gives you some idea, and I'm not going to go through the entire slide deck because it includes a summary of every county's plan. That you can look at your leisure and get a better understanding how each county is tackling this issue. I mentioned behavioral health care needs, including addressing trauma in substance abuse. The legislature last year adopted a House resolution on childhood on trauma and addressing trauma and creating a culture of trauma awareness. And that came up as teenagers throughout these counties. There was a lot of emphasis on home visiting through the use of mentors. There's a real strong feeling that the way this is going to be addressed is through one-on-one individualization with in-home types of support, so that came out. As I mentioned, behavioral health was a huge theme, and many of the counties feel that they need to have some sort of assessment tool to try and deal with non-cognitive behavioral needs, like resilience and executive functioning, in order to better prepare children for success. We know that low-income children, particularly children growing up in extreme poverty, are having challenges in these areas due to adverse childhood experiences and toxic stress that they're experiencing and trauma. So recognizing that as a foundational issue, those areas need to be addressed, we think was very encouraging.
Tracy, I have a question for you regarding the mentorship programs that you're seeing that were presented by the various counties. I know that those of us that have been following the use of peer mentors within the area of substance abuse recovery programs see that when individuals are aligned with mentors who have been through their experience, that they're usually more success with those programs. And so I wanted to see if you're seeing those types of mentorship programs or if it's looking for people who volunteer to help that may not necessarily have had those experiences or appreciate the challenges effectively of the people that they're working with.
Great question. Many of the counties have not yet figured out what type of mentoring model they're going to adopt. Some of them are looking at a program called Circles, which some of you may be familiar with, that actually does do mentoring, and it includes volunteers and people who successfully completed the Circles program. It's a national model, and it's been getting really positive outcomes. I think what's positive is that all of them recognize that if they're going to be doing even a volunteering type of mentoring program, that there needs to be some kind of training curriculum that's universal across the state. And this is where the commission member agencies really do have a role, because in this area, the Department of Human Services, depending on what type of home visiting model it is, if it's early childhood parenting, home visiting, evidence-based, nurse-family partnerships, parents as teachers through the Department of Health, those are already really well established in the state, and any of the counties that are focusing on that form of home visiting will be strongly encouraged to follow an evidence-based model or research-based model. For the other mentoring programs connecting to students and families, the agencies have a role to help, given their expertise, establish those curriculums. And that's like as we're moving toward implementation with these counties, that's the next phase of the conversation, which is how do you give them, what type of training do these mentors need that's universal across the area so they're equipped to provide that mentorship, even if they themselves haven't experienced intergenerational poverty as a child or as an adult.
And I appreciate that it makes sense. I'm glad that you're focusing on, you know, the programs that are already proven to try to encourage those counties to utilize those and standardizing it, because I think that obviously is going to help so much with your data collection on outcomes. Since we did this, did it make a difference? And I worry, I understand the challenge of allowing the counties to localize and tailor it to their specific community, but again, if there are no standards or if there's no, if they're all over the map in terms of what they're measuring or what the program looks like, then I think that makes it very difficult to know whether that particular approach was really, that works as effectively as it could. I know that we've seen it in other cases and with other populations, but, you know, I appreciate you talking about, so it's, it's called the Circles Curriculum, is that what it is?
It's called the Circles Program, and it used to be Utah Circles, and they recently changed the branch or affiliation here in Utah. Used to be called Utah Circles, and they changed their name, and their name is escaping me. But they have Utah County, they're now in Washington County. There's a couple other counties that are implementing Circles, and not every county is going to utilize the Circles model for their mentoring program, but it's one that's getting a lot of attention and discussion.
Oh, okay. So, I'm trying, there's right now a crisis happening with the home visiting programs, I'm sure you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, we passed legislation last year on that, just the standards and what needs to have evidence-based home visiting programs, and the federal government defines, or is it CMS, I guess, defines evidence-based, there's a couple of them, right? So we know, for example, the one that we're facing with that crisis right now, which is a nurse family partnership program with a budget cut that came out of the law, I mean, a little bit off how it happened. Are you guys going to, now as the Intergenerational Poverty Commission or whatever it's called, are you guys also have an opportunity to say, look, this is part of our strategy and we're concerned that this is happening? I mean, are you guys working in collaboration with the Department of Health? The reason why I'm asking this is, it took me a while to understand the administrative process on how they cut that budget, and what I've learned is that it happened in an internal meeting within the Department of Health, under their governance committee. I didn't know they have their own governance committee, and they're the ones that make that recommendation. So I'm thinking, if this is where we have all these people maybe working with good intentions and all trying to help the same group of people. But if we're losing a huge program that is evidence-based, have you had an opportunity as a commission to say something to the Department of Health, or are you guys planning on intervening? Because I'm looking at your strategy, because it seems to be, a pretty high, a high standard of strategy in those conditioning programs. So I don't know if you guys thought about that.
So the Department of Health at the last intergenerational, I don't know how the decision came about. My understanding was that it was the federal budget who cut the grant to Utah for NICD funding. But I'm not in the Department of Health, so I don't know about this governance committee. I do know that at the last Welfare Reform Commission meeting on July 12th, all of the agencies were required, commission agencies, in almost all of the cases represented by their executive director, explain where they're at on the recommendations that were adopted, one of which was expanding home visits, or ensuring that first-time parents or young parents had access to home visiting if they're experiencing intergenerational poverty. And the Department of Health reported on that and very clearly expressed serious concern about the $3 million cut that's occurring to home visiting. I think that my understanding of the way that they're dealing with that cut is converting from a nurse family partnership model to the parents as teachers model, which is also an evidence-based home visiting model that's eligible for NICD funding. That's the maternal infant, I don't know what it all stands for, early health home visiting program, to federal funding stream, that they're switching in order to deal with the cut to parents as teachers because it's a more affordable model. In the nurse family partnership model, you actually have to have RNs going to the homes, which is a lot more expensive. In the parents as teachers model, it's a parent volunteer who does training and goes into the home and provides that home visiting, but it's based on a curriculum that has been nationally normed and researched. So that's my understanding. It's probably a really good question to ask the Department of Health how they're planning to do it. I just know from the commission perspective, it was discussed by the Department of Health as an area of serious concern, because I think all of the commission members recognize the value of an evidence-based home visiting model in dealing with reductions in abuse and neglect, improvements in parenting and supporting child healthy development, and even in a lot of cases, connecting parents to employment and getting them kind of
on their feet and moving in that direction.
Just a follow-up. Thank you. So that helps at least to know that there's that conversation. You're right, the budget cut came from the federal government, which we should all be expecting those type of cuts throughout this administration. The problem is, so the firm has made an administrative decision on prioritizing where the money goes now that they've cut. The only key I think that's important as we say, the state, not only the commission on intergenerational poverty, but the state itself, but certainly has said we want evidence base. So, out of the evidence base, you have one that has higher return on investment numbers, and, the nearest family partnership has a higher ROI just based on the fact that there's an RM to let go, health, train on health and so forth. It's a little bit different. Not that, parent teacher programs are not good and effective, just different types of programs. And, especially for very, very young families of young, teenage parenting issues, tends to be very, very effective to have the nurse family partnership. But I'm glad to hear that that conversation happening, and I think it will be up to us how we deal with that. Also, I think as the legislature, but it took me a while to understand the process to see who made that decision, which I thought it was interesting. As we struggle sometimes with some of the state agencies that I believe sometimes do more, take more of what their responsibility is and should be more of a legislative decision how that money is spent. That's an editorial on the side. Mm-hmm. Thank you. That helps to know. And so July 12th is when you guys have that meeting. So.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
And just another side note about both of those programs, they both have really different eligibility requirements. Your family partnership, they have to be in the program, I think, under second trimester. And you have to be a first-time parent. And parents and teachers is a little bit more flexible in that regard. So having both in our state, and there's even a special, another home visiting, evidence-based home visiting program that's for the Native American population. So having that kind of mix of them, given the population, is also really valuable. And to only go to one represents challenges.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So just going back to some of the other common strategies, I talked about the behavioral health assessment, the non-cognitive behavioral health assessment. I think there's also, there was a lot of emphasis on early childhood, although I wouldn't say it was the biggest thing, which kind of surprised me. But there is also, in many of the counties, a need of educating parents. Parents is first and most important teachers, and making sure that they have the knowledge that they need just to support their child's healthy development. And there are conversations, again, at the meeting on the 12th, a discussion about where we're headed with public awareness campaigns in that area. Some other areas were around preschool, chronic absence rates in schools, after-school strategies, and post-secondary training and education. Definitely barriers and challenges came out. Of course, resources is always an issue, and that's a challenge for the state and for the commission without any question. But there are also some barriers and challenges that were highlighted that go beyond resources, including data sharing. There is a desire by the counties to identify these families. There are very restrictive privacy laws that we are bound by, which limits our ability as the Department of Workforce Services or any of the agencies to give a list of families to a county, and we are trying to work with them to figure out other ways to identify these families, and we're confident that they're going to be able to do that. I mentioned the lack of standard mentoring models and curriculum. That's a barrier, if that's what their strategies that involve. Common intake and database across all of the state agencies that are serving these families. The eight commission agencies are working to indicate across agencies whether or not a family is receiving services from multiple agencies without violating privacy, so without going into details about what those services may be. But if you're a caseworker in DWS, if a family also has a case with DHS, there would be indication of that. And then the caseworkers can try and get a waiver from the family to help coordinate that too. So that was also a theme that came up. There were some innovations. This will kind of highlight a few of those. Cayuse County focused on a community garden, not only as a way to provide food for the community, but also an area of training for families who might be, for parents who might be unemployed. Iron County really, the light bulb went off for them when they were all required to start to meet, that all of the resources, service providers existing in Iron County didn't know that each other exists. Which is not uncommon in these counties, even for the smaller ones. So they got routed, if you notice, if we have this community resource clearinghouse to provide that. Then there was a discussion about educating policymakers on the disproportionate resources available in rural Utah to address behavioral health issues. Common theme, lack of behavioral health services in these counties. So as we're, it's great to know that there's a behavioral health need, which there is for this population in many instances, but if that health need can't be addressed, what benefit, how are we actually serving these families? So there was one of the counties said we need to educate our policymakers so they really understand how severe this shortage is. And then there was a discussion about master teachers who are equipped to serve this population. So really interesting information, strategies, out-of-the-box thinking has come forward in many of these counties. Just really quick, I'll show you, starting with Beaver County, how we organize the slides going forward for each of the counties. We emphasize which commission goal they are working on in their plans, what areas of concern were elevated in their plans, and what their key strategies are. We highlighted what assumptions they made in their plan and what barriers and challenges. So you can see that for all 13 of the counties.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, for example, in Beaver, I was looking at your, kind of like their priorities. You have home visiting again as their number one priority. Are they utilizing money from intergenerational poverty for those programs to kind of like help the current home visiting funding, or how does that work?
At this point, there's been no intergenerational poverty funding for any of these initiatives. That's across the state for all of the work that's being done. So, no, they're not getting any funding from the state for that.
So, and I remember you were here, didn't we talk about this last time? So I was clarified, and I can't remember if it's like this committee or someone. So what's been clarified, and maybe you can help us put it on the record, is how much money has the state provided to any work on intergenerational poverty, and that money currently is not only in drafting a plan, $25,000 grants for drafting plans, but no funding to the programs themselves. Can you clarify that?
So I'll say a couple things. One, the counties that developed plans got $15,000 each. They were required to bring in mandatory partners across all of the areas that would impact vulnerable families. Some of them added two partners onto that in their planning process. They were also required to hire a facilitator to lead the discussion. What I always say, and I don't know if this is a satisfactory answer, but the Intergenerational Poverty Initiative was designed to pull together the data and the research to identify gaps and help inform policy making, not just legislative policy making, but also administrative policy making and rule making to try and address the gaps. And what it has allowed us initially to do as a state is to look at where programs we know are going to help move the needle, where those investments are being made, and are they properly targeted. So as a state, there has never been, including when the initiative was initially adopted, funding that went towards the initiative. So the only funding that was used was the $15,000 per county.
What was the budget? What was the fiscal amount of that bill? Was it 2012?
There was no official
letter. No. On Senator Reed's bill, never.
No.
When it passed, so you did. So we passed the bill with no funding. Nice. So far. So we passed the bill, we made this big thing about it, and there was no funding.
Correct.
And then, so DWS picked the cost of gathering that data, which is what you do, is that correct?
Part of my role, yeah.
What, one of the many things you do. So, so that's, I was trying to clarify that. People believe that there is funding, stream money going to this initiative, but there's not.
No, but I would say that when you're looking at all the areas of child well-being, again, if you identify gaps, I can speak to early childhood and child care specifically, when we're thinking about making funding decisions with our federal resources, the data that's being revealed in the Intergenerational Poverty Initiative is part of the decision-making that goes on. And I think that that's happening across all of the agencies that are working on this effort. So it's been less a matter of new money for new programs and more a matter of analyzing the data to figure out where the gaps are and properly targeting the populations that need access to the programs, be it after school, child care, different forms of case management. Our case management model of workforce services has changed as a result of this. Has it required new money? No. It's just the practice, the way we're doing business and serving families has changed to be more family-focused in our approach. So in that regard, in many cases, it doesn't even require new money. It's just to inform decision-making in a much more profound way. Once that decision-making is occurring, and then you realize we still, even with making sure that this population receives the resources that it needs and the access to opportunity that it needs, but it's still not enough, I think that's when you get to the next part of the discussion, and I think home visiting is a really good example of that. We know it's a great evidence-based program. We're barely scratching the surface on the need, and I think it's a question about whether or not there's going to be an effort to ensure that the funding that's being cut from the federal government is somehow being picked up.
Let me follow up, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. This is very important. So what you're saying is because of a focus and maybe addressing data in a different way and, you know, assessment tools to see where the numbers are and not focusing on a specific population, different practices have changed, for example, within the Department of Workforce Services, as an example, in terms of the case management, correct?
Yes.
So this has been very helpful. We're happy. That's great. The state has not invested on any of that, I mean, except for, I guess, our staff that is being utilized, for example, in your case, that even though there's not extra money for that, you're still, you know, doing that job aside from your other responsibilities.
Very much aligned with the child care.
So, correct, overall. So there was a policy decision made to change, I guess, or emphasize some of the practices that we're doing on closing the gap of intergenerational poverty. Those are happening. But there's still gaps on services. I mean, I guess the bottom line is, unless you're telling me that we have all the funding available and we're fine, you know, with regards to early childhood education, home visiting programs, after school programs, because we're hearing from outside the opposite, right? I mean, I just came from a 7 a.m. meeting with some schools where after school, which they got cut out of the program, and they're very concerned about the 21st century grant, they're panicking. I just want to make sure I'm not, you know, maybe I need to go back and reassess where all this information is coming from, because if we're just now moving where the money's going and maybe funding, I mean, that's good. I think we can do that versus holy cow, we may end up having to find money to fund programs. Because it's just, you know, in a way, what I'm hearing from them is there's a lack of funding for programs, and what you're saying is as long as we're putting the money where it's supposed to be, which I think is great, that we're focusing where it needs to be focused. But are we lacking funding? Because the state is not investing at all. I think they should be investing more. We should be investing in the state. We're just utilizing federal money, which we don't like, and we always criticize them, but then we lack their money. So, you know, I'm trying to figure out where we get the money if there's some lack of services. And if there's no lack of services, you know, that would be awesome. But I guess in my district, they feel there's a lack of services. especially on those after school program and the early and the home visiting program?
I think we're trying, the commission's trying to get to that very question about after services. If you look at the last year's report and the previous year's report, at least based on the schools, we have a spreadsheet for all of the schools with the highest rates of intergenerational poverty as an appendix to the report that says, are they offering a preschool program? Are they offering an optional extended day? Are they offering an after school? Are they offering access to school-based behavioral health specialists? And you can see which schools don't have that. Is there enough resources to realign to those schools? Or, you know, as policymakers, does that gap need to be covered?
If I may address this a little bit, my understanding of IGP is that there are, I mean, there were initially some massive assessments around the state and some goals set out and assessing where the gaps are and then some strategies how to meet those gaps. Their role sort of, ends at that point, and policymakers' role takes over where now we can see what are the gaps because we have this fantastic data and they are doing things differently, but their gaps still remain. And then our role as policymakers is to how do we change policies and including funding to address those remaining gaps. And the IGP folks in January or December, they have a meeting where legislators can come and present their policies, and then IGP determines if those policies fits within their goals that they have set that are evidence-based, and that's really unique nationwide. I think you guys are getting a lot of notoriety on that. But the thing for us is to, as you're saying, and the three of us are on social services approach together, and so we hear these discussions, and Ms. Cornelia was just at social services last week presenting. I mean, this was much more in depth today, so helpful.
Yeah.
But it's critical that we understand these issues so we can dispel many of these myths, because I do think there is an assumption that there is this deep trough of money we keep pouring into IGP, and that's just not really what the role of IGP ever has been or probably ever will be. You have a very, very important role, but it's not requesting money. You're putting out information, and that's really where we come into play. And our policy subcommittee is an important piece of that as well.
So, ancillary to that piece of what you just said, and the fact that last year we saw this opportunity for legislators who had ideas for policies to tackle some of the concerns addressed through IDP, I felt it was almost like a free-for-all from our side in terms of the legislators. People get contacted by vendors, I'll be honest by that, or by other organizations that have the silver bullet. And then that they come to IGP and say, this is our solution. And I think that, in my opinion, it should be the other way around. That IGP or the Welfare Commission should say, these are the policy levers that we see need help, or these are the gaps that we see need improvement, whether it's statutorily or through financing. And then you come to us and say, this is where we see the improvements being made, instead of it being the other way around. Because my concern is we have things that you're finding through data and through identified through these now moving into the county plans that you're going to see it would really make a big difference statewide, even though they're locally tailored, if the legislature could put attention towards X or Y. And instead of all of us as legislators coming up with the next great idea ourselves, that it's driven by what the data is showing, what the counties need, and make it the other way around. So I guess what I'm saying to you and to IDP and to the Welfare Commission is if you see those pockets, to let us know, and then we'd be more than happy to maybe look at those areas as where we need to make those policy changes.
And I don't know whether you see it that way, but that's kind of what I saw happening last year. People coming out with some of these great new ideas, which we signed in on, which we passed, but I don't know whether they're aligning to this. It was more like, here's my idea, figure out a way to make it fit within IGP versus IGP saying, this is what we're identifying as the gaps. Legislature, this is what we want you to focus on. And I you know, I might have knowledge to evaluate whether that's an accurate perception or not.
Well, I think there has been a cachet of IGP and aligning something that is a pet project to IGP and tapping into that, because it is very, very, the work that you're doing is very well respected, and so there is a desire to, I think, tap into that. And from, I mean, I've presented legislation to your, to the committee that then tries if it receives your approval or not. And I know it's a deep scrutiny. So it, I think you do a good job of weeding out, you know, the things that may not fully align as well. But my question for you in hearing this discussion with us is, how well are we as legislators adhering to your recommendations? I know on your 5 and 10, you know, your yearly, your year-end report does include recommendations in your four areas. And how well are we as a legislature addressing your recommendations? And do you feel like it was, are we having sufficient conversations and interactions, I guess, on this area? Or where do you see the relationship between the legislature and IGP, including the Welfare Commission, is that working well? Could it be strengthened in some way?
I think that last year presented just a little bit of a challenge because the 5 and 10 year plan didn't come out until right before the start of this legislative session, and that was the first time they made explicit recommendations. So I think that up until that point, people would approach, legislators would approach us and say, I'm thinking about doing this, but not everyone does. And despite the commission's efforts to invite, and we, the commission emails the entire legislature to say, this hearing is taking place, or this meeting is the time for you to provide an opportunity for the commission to evaluate the legislation. I think they want to do both things. It has to stay true to the data and the research and the commission agencies. The commission members have the expertise to evaluate that in a way that not everybody else does. So for them to come to the commission with their policies, if they are willing, is incredibly important. And we have seen some great proposals around early childhood and optional extended day kindergarten and saving for education that have come to the commission. Sometimes there are things that come to the commission that very clearly do not align, and the commission says this doesn't align with our goals and it's not going to get what you might think it's going to get. So that's not a great answer. I think we're moving in the right direction now that there's actually been recommendations that have been put out there. And the hope is that if that's an area of interest to a policymaker, that they're going to look at those recommendations and say, this is an area that I'm concerned about. Let's work with the commission and make sure that the way we're crafting it aligns with the goals and is guided by the data. So I think moving forward, there will be much closer alignment. But there is no question that there is some degree of concern by the commission that policies are being tabbed as intergenerational poverty, but there's absolutely no data and no research that supports that strategy is going to move the needle for these families. It has to stay true to that effort and to that focus that was adopted by the legislature beginning in 2012.
That concludes your presentation.
It does.
Okay. Any other questions? Mr. Burkholder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I listened to this great presentation, lots of good information. There are parallel commissions and efforts going on in the state that, at least to some degree, are focused on the same population.
And my question has to do with the, not only the intersection of those different areas, but the coordination and the conversation. So what particularly came to mind is all of the work that's been done on the issue of homelessness, also out of DWS, as well as local municipalities and state government. There's work being done on issues of domestic violence and on substance abuse. Some of these issues all intersect one another. If you were to do a Venn diagram, you would see that, and I'm sure you've done that many times. So my question to you is one of, is asking about conversation, coordination, alignment across systems and agencies to benefit this group of people that you've been identifying, and can you speak to any changes and improvements in this area in the past few years since IGC?
In the area of coordination across
coordination, conversation, I mean, we could give one example, the issue of trauma. How are you, everything that you have learned about trauma and the impact on children over their lifespans, what conversations are taking place with people in the domestic violence arena, in the homelessness arena, in the substance abuse arena, to share data, coordinate strategies, develop policies that align with the best research you've been able to come up with?
Well, there's no question, and this is a real positive thing for our state, that these areas are getting a lot of attention now. And I don't wouldn't necessarily say it's all related to intergenerational poverty, but issues of education and issues of homelessness and early childhood, I mean, there are a lot of meetings with lots of different people who have really great intentions starting up a group on early childhood or housing affordability. And there is significant overlap. And the challenge for the commission is to make sure that they're informed of what's going on in all of those arenas without yet establishing another work group. So in the area of trauma, the commission actually established last spring the trauma subcommittee, headed by Dr. Doug Goldsmith from the Children's Center. And he has pulled together many experts in the field of trauma and also people who are working in that population, including with domestic violence, to be part of the discussion about how to become a trauma-informed state. And a little bit of the background or context about that is that trauma was becoming an issue that was being elevated. There was interest of members of our community and influential members of our community. And rather than start off down the path of another initiative to bring that work under the umbrella of the Welfare Reform Commission, because they are doing all the research and looking at issues of trauma that are overlapping to the extent that we can provide that data. So that subcommittee is charged with dealing with and establishing some sort of a plan for the state to become more trauma-informed. There are some other areas like housing affordability and the Homeless Task Force, and the commission has said, we don't need another separate subcommittee on housing and homelessness because we have experts over in the task force that are working on this issue. We just need to make sure that there's a linkage and that there's recommendations coming out of there that are also going to impact the intergenerational poverty population, that those efforts are aligned.
So you've got established formal linkages across systems.
We have linkages across systems, for sure. And because the commission agencies are made up of those five members, as well as the lieutenant governor, those conversations are happening to juvenile justice reforms in other areas. That we've got the juvenile court administrator sitting on the commission. She's also very much involved in the juvenile justice reform, so making that linkage, reporting to the commission, providing information on what needs to be happening moving forward is occurring.
Great. I mean, I think that's very important, not only intergovernmentally, but in the whole universe of who it is that cares about the issue, that people be brought in. Otherwise, we're going to have just the proliferation of individual effort, whether it's by a government agency, or it's a nonprofit, or it's a business consortium. So, just a question about this.
Great. Okay, any other questions or comments? Mr. Freaking.
Thank you. I just had a comment from a county level, having served as a business facilitator. And I think it goes back to Tracy's very first point, and that is if you can identify the individuals that the data is, the disaggregated data reflects, then you can understand what services they're needing and accessing, and then you can see if there is coordination of services around that individual, et cetera. So the fundamental primary need is really to find a way to either support the effort to data share in some way or some workaround so that all of those activities can happen. And at the local level, those are that's the number one thing that we're tackling right now, is just either, is there a way to do it? Is there not a way to do it? And if there's not a way to do it, then what are we going to do? But at some point, we have to get past that, because that's a fundamental question that you can't go any further without knowing who the individuals are. And then providing services to them so you can do the benchmark and the data changing over time.
Thank you. All right, seeing no other questions, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Lots to think about. And please thank all of folks at BWS who are working so well on this issue.
Will do.
Okay, Senator Espina, you're up.
I apologize. I wasn't hearing your question. I need to go in a few minutes. I'm
just going to wait.
That's okay. Yes. And I do. I thought I'd have a great update.
Oh, that's great. Thanks. We'll just start with you, Commissioner Wallace.
Yes, thank you. I don't have a great update because I just got back from maternity leave, but I wanted to mention that to you. Thank you for your card and your gift. And what I would like to do is reinvigorate the marketing committee and the communications committee so that we can move forward. So I need to go back and make sure I have done where we're at because I've been gone for 3 months, but I do appreciate it. Thank you. That's my update.
If I can just add, while you were on maternity leave, Commissioner Robinson followed up with the folks with the website, the group. And so she actually sent this message last night that they had done an update, and it is live now. So it'll probably continue to need some tweaking, but we'll make sure that gets sent out to everyone. But we put in what we got, and then we've gone ahead and made that live, and so we've got that up and going. So, but if any of you have suggestions or are interested in serving with Commissioner Wallace on the Communications Committee, it looks like Commissioner Barnett would like to do that. We do need to reinvigorate it. Let's help you add some additional people to that so that we can get it up and going. Thank you.
With the research, as Commissioner, research subcommittee, who would anyone like to report there?
We didn't catch Jim.
Yeah, she left. I don't know, because last before we could hear from her, but Commissioner Burkholder?
I know very little about this, except to say that there are still efforts underway to have the successor study and survey to the focus groups that were completed last year. So there are still efforts being made to try to find something for that. And an ancillary point to that is I will let you know that I ran into Susan Cohen again last week, who was the person that helped us facilitate the Walmart Foundation grant. She said they may be, even though they didn't fund it last year, they may be open now to another application. So, and I'm going to connect with Cam, I guess, to resend at least the report to Susan and see if we can get that reinvigorated again, that connection. She said that the foundation is, she says, I'm a little frustrated with the foundation because they're focusing on things that are very important, but things more like food banks and things like that, but they want to do more of these research projects again. So it might be, there might be an opening again. So we're going to, I'll reconnect
her with Pam and Commissioner Robinson to see if we can get aligned with this year's. Because they usually do the process in the early fall, so maybe we can get in the loop for this year's round of funding and get that survey work done. So I will do that.
And then lastly, policy. So we haven't had a meeting since the last time we met, but what today was an effort to feed our discussion as to the direction we may want to go policy-wise in making recommendations. So we had asked, and appreciate Commissioner Brigham reaching out to Gina, to get her report, and that's what we heard today, and then also the IGP follow-up to see where we're at. And Representative Edwards and I had a great conversation with the chamber yesterday about some of the things she's working on, and just generally about some of the issues that we've carried in the past policy-wise. So we're in the data gathering stage, or the information gathering stage, of where we need to focus. One of the areas that they are interested in hearing more about, and actually at NCSL next week, there's going to be a presentation by the Center for, I can't remember which group it is. There is a group that is going to be doing a presentation on child care policy in the several states, and I'm going to make a point of trying to get there to that meeting so that I can find out what some other states are doing. Because that's an area that we know through the report that we just did, the focus groups continue to percolate to the top, that if we don't start tackling these issues related to child care, that it's just really hard to get through the rest of it. So don't want to drop the ball on that, but we'll be doing some investigation on other states that are working on child care policy. And then we're going to hear from Senator Estes as part of that policy discussion.
Thank you. You have a copy of the bill, so I'm coming back to the committee on that strategic plan for equal compensation. Please note my House sponsor in that bill. Thank you. It does make a difference, especially if you're a Democrat or your sponsor, you know, in the other chamber. So this is, again, the idea that we're, you know, as we may end up facing, I think, you know, with Gina and all the information we're gathering, that we may end up facing a very difficult year in the next couple of years at the federal level, and a lot of those funding is going to be cut, and some budget decisions are going to be made. I think we're going to be hurting, and this is the time again to start talking about equal compensation. And I know, Senator Jake Enberg, and we both presented this with our bills together. His bill focusing mostly on the private sector, and my bill is focusing only on state government, by the way. To me, that's a good start, because then we can, A, have access to data. I mean, we can actually have information. So the bill does is just basically talks about having the Department of Human Resource Management submit a strategic plan to eliminate gender-based wage discrimination. And with establishing that strategic plan, they will gather the data that we don't have right now. So right now, no one has ever gathered that data. So it came at the end of the session, so you know, a lot of it is timing, but I'm trying to line up support at this point. When our DHRM was very helpful to the point that it came out of a serial fiscal note, that they were that interested, but they will work on putting it within their budget, which is always nice. So it shouldn't be a fiscal concern or cost. But I think what's important is they were going to make it so it was broad enough to have enough information, because it's hard to compare apples to oranges, and I get that. It's just to use the gender versus wage, it's not an accurate way of assessing whether there's some level of discrimination. You need to see all the other factors. For example, if women decide to take some time off in their careers to be a single mom, or fathers for that matter, you know, the years of experience are going to change, and that will impact obviously someone's ability in terms of their wages, how much they get paid. So all of that needs to be considered. We work really hard with them, and you know, they're very, because they are human resources, they're very careful, And I think this language is what makes them feel comfortable, and I feel that's a good approach to start with. So I'm hoping to get the support of this group so that we can continue the conversations and you know, move forward. If you guys have seen any language that we can change, this is fine, so I can go back to the HR and maybe add or subtract or change the language. It will be helpful to get your feedback in the next month, and then go back and hopefully, you know, I already filed for the bill, so the bill's already, there's already a bill filed for this. And hopefully we can get the HR, you know, I mean, they were very helpful in explaining why this is important. It's not an easy sell in the legislature, and now we want, I mean, as Senator Andrew says, this is own struggle. His struggles are worse than mine. I mean, it's an uphill battle for him. It is going to be difficult, but I think if they make compromise of saying, look, we'll start somewhere, and maybe this is an incremental step process, and this could be a good step. I mean, because if we can't control or see what's happening within our house or state government, it's hard to go outside and start demanding from other entities. So this may be a good place to start.
A couple of questions. Thank you, Senator. Commissioner Ivana.
Thank you. I had the opportunity yesterday to review both bills here, both of the testimonies of these bills, and I just want to commend you. I felt so proud. He did a wonderful job. I thought Aaron of the YWCA was very, very wonderful. But this is, and only because, of course, I come from an environment where there is no discrimination against wages, but there is this discrimination. And it was quite apparent when I was listening to your colleague speak on his bill, and that is that when we're brought into the fold saying that we have to go to a PTA meeting, or maybe there's a play at school, that these might be the reasons that we're discriminated against wages. And I feel personally, as a single mom, and any of you as working moms, that this is just an insult to what a family does, and not a female and not a male, in your family, if you attend these various things, and if you decide that you want some flex hours, you know that your cell phone is on 24/7, and all of those things. So I am just really going to work with you and get my colleagues to rise to the occasion on this bill. I think it's really important to get the data. And if that data is going to come up that we have discrimination out there because we want to go to the parent-teacher conference, we've got a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
We have a lot of work to do. So thank you so much, Commissioner Eskimo, and I'm going to be working hard.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Friedman.
Yes, so I'm definitely not an expert on policy language, but I would like to piggyback on her comments, and that is, A, I'd love to help you. B is, in terms of messaging, I think if there's a way to, I think it makes everybody nervous using the word discrimination, even though that's precisely what's happening, but in terms of messaging, and I'm wondering, because you guys know kind of the what you're asked us to, I wonder if some even just initial data on what the from HR maybe is elected pilot group.
We know it.
So yeah. Okay.
We've shared that with the group out, and I can have it email again. So they already did.
Okay.
So this came out of this because of the
answer
this. So okay. We talked about this a year ago. And I thought, oh, let's just call the HRN to get numbers.
Yeah.
And they have to subcontract an outside person because it is that challenging for them.
Right.
Because it is because of discrimination laws and everything. Yeah. So we did get that info. So what it shows, and again, going back a little bit to what Commissioner Burnett was mentioning, it is hard to compare apples to oranges. So for example, what they did sample sizes on specific jobs, right? So there was an analysis of wage according to gender by a business intelligence consultant that was subcontracted by the state. Thanks to my request. Surprised I didn't get the bill for that. But anyway. So what it came, I mean, they explained the methodology, and I'll have it, you know, to our staff person, and that could be distributed. But basically, it shows, you know, it goes by position, so like very, everything from, you know, DDS consultant, medical doctors, they sample positions in the state and they sample numbers.
Right.
And there is some gaps. I mean, there's one where there's only one woman in the entire department division within transportation. So for them, it's like, look, I mean, she actually makes more money than all of the other guys. Because she also has a PhD. So, I mean, it was just, to the point where we learned is that it is difficult. It's not going to be this simple, just sampling a group of people, but they did. So we do have this as a base. It's not, you know, it's not as robust, but I think you guys will look at, you know, it says, you know, for example, assistants, you have a lot of women. So you have positions where it's like 90% women, and you have positions where it's 99% men. And having you, you know, in there is like hard, but I can share that. So we do have already something from state government, which is nice.
Here's what my head was at. My head was from a conversation piece of if you do have the data, let's say you have a female that has equal, that means you find an instance, rather than say there's this many females that has less or 80%, and because you know that they're going to track. So one of my thought processes was, okay, well, if you have those individuals, doing an assessment, an economic benefit assessment of, okay, what if those women were paid the comparable rate? Then they become a higher taxpayer, and then you take that money to then pay them more, right? So it would like create a sustainable economic churn and start talking about the issue in that way, because, I mean, it's very clear we've been talking a long time about misperceptions and stereotypes and sexism and, you know, all of those issues and education levels, maternity, I mean, all of those are very important, but maybe if we tweak it a little bit and sort of androgynize the conversation and say, this is an economic, direct economic benefit. If you do this, the state gets more money, right? Because this is how much, so I heard it, and I don't know where I heard it from, so please, I hope this isn't recording or something, but so don't mark this down.
Yeah,
it will be clear. All right, well, I'll say it, and then, but I'll caveat it with, it could be pure wrong. But I heard that potentially state or county, there was a number of police officers that were on food stamps because they weren't making enough money.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if we could look at
on troopers,
okay. So take that as an example, and then I mean, how much money diverting food stamps to increase wages, right, livable wages, would that create then more taxable? Not very much, right? In a 5% income tax environment. But how does that create sort of that sales tax and that economic churn? Just talk about the conversation in terms of strategies. So using the data that you already have to sort of do some forecasting or projection in terms of economic churn, I think maybe that in part with all of the others, but here are all the issues. But here's sort of potential strategies that, hey, come back and androgynize the economic churn of sales tax and decrease welfare, right? Right? You have savings, you have revenue generation, and you have social impact. Right? So those three categories, talking through those, might help with all of this, you know, get the legislation passed with whoever's trying to do these sorts of things. I'm not the expert here, but that's a great way to message for the conversation.
So if you listen to a testimony, I mean, the Commissioner Burnett, from both bills, right?
Right.
Because I think the state one was a little more friendly to what Senator Andrea received. So the problem that we're facing is they don't believe there's a gap. So I mean, we're like the what you're saying is this will be, you know, we're like back maybe 100 years, right? Something like that. For example, the study that I mentioned, the median wage for the top 15 jobs by gender count. It shows a gap of $3 almost an hourly wage, to give an example. So, I mean, you know, we can go and say that, but then what happens is, to Senator Andrea's point, we make this point that I can have this amount of studies that tells me there's no gap, and this amount of studies that tells me there's a gap from reputable entities. Like, it's really crazy. Like, I mean, which will tell you how you can manipulate data,
yeah,
either way, right? But what I'm doing with this tool, the bill, what it does, if you look at the bill, it really goes into detail. That's why BHRM was excited about it, because it's just not gender position gap. I mean, because that's, I'm going to get someone who says, well, no, what I was explaining, right? 5 years off the job. How do you explain that? None, I mean, he went into the PTA, but there's like, we went off for 5 years and took a little absence, I don't know. Some scenarios that could apply to both genders, right? Not gender specific. So, no, I agree. I think the numbers, there is a lot of data, by the way. The state has never done it. So what was interesting that we learned when we requested this information is that no one has ever asked the state of Utah, Department of Human Resource Management, for this data. And that's where they actually, there's just a woman that leads this division with DHRM said, I've been here for 20 years, I want to do this. This could definitely change our conversation. There is that support. I think on what Senator Ackert is trying to do is a little bit different. It will actually, that is more of our requirement to bring parity into wages in a way that they'll be reporting back to the state. Where, so he's, like I said, his bill is different, very different. And so I like the idea of getting some numbers in terms of, you know, revenue, taxes, and all of that.
Yeah. What are you leaving here in terms of caution revenue?
Absolutely not. I like it. And the reality is, just looking for a company, you know, saying you're right. So we've had a lot of troopers on Tuesday. So when they, even when we were having conversations about all this food stamps recipients having to, or sorry, is it SNAP now? We actually changed that. SNAP recipients have to take a class on fiscal responsibility. They're like, nice, you're not, your troopers now taking a class on fiscal responsibility. We end up excluding that, by the way. But what I'm saying is, that is how, you know, ironic this whole conversation is, right? Like, we're penalizing our own employees, for corrections and troopers, which are law enforcement.
That's what they're allowed.
Yeah, but we don't trust them on with them. So anyway, I appreciate that. You definitely took a good approach.
So I would love to volunteer to help in any way that you would like. And then my other comment is, I do a lot of consulting with businesses. And anytime I go to a consultant who says, I have a need for workforce, what can I do? So many of them are so willing to, they just don't know. Right, so flux hours, and here's how you can be more woman friendly, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. So as we can sort of educate and create awareness there, I think that would be important as well, because I think there's a ton of employers who would say, yeah, I'll do that, that's great. There's some that still won't.
Right.
So, I mean, that's, it's reality, but I think that there is an awareness piece, and what I want to say to that is, you know, we talk about jobs in the state of Utah, and we, when we recruit in Facebook or Google or multiple employers and jobs, that counts, and we didn't have taxes for those. Well, perhaps maybe in some of this, there could be a tax incentive for those employers who are found to maybe have a problem and fix the problem, or something like that, right? Because we talk about tax incentives all the time, so there must be some mechanism to use that. Why not use that in this? If this is an economic impact issue, not just a woman's issue, then let's really use all of the resources we have from an economic development standpoint to solve the problem of create revenues, right? Save costs and create social economy.
Thank you. So you're continuing to work on this. I'm thinking maybe we're going to have two more meetings this year, one in October on the 3rd, the 3rd, and then in December. So either one of those, just let us know if you want to make, you know, if you're ready to make a motion to ask us to approve it December the 5th. So we could either do the October or the December, depending on what you're doing. December. Okay, I just didn't know whether you were going to present it in summer or not, or you're going to wait. December, just every other month. So December is December 5th and October 3rd. October 3rd is my last meeting.
Well, it would be a challenge to get that done.
So anyway, so this is what we know, and then also we'll spread the word about our legislative colleagues that if they have those to present for our consideration, that we those two.
I think this is a really nice target, and one that the commission has could get, I mean, everybody needs represented. I can't let Anna, and I think it's a really fun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For our October meeting, or perhaps December, could we invite Representative Ward to come and talk about his bill about access to contraception and family planning? I think that that is another bill that this piece of work that this commission really needs to understand, and there may be things that we can support for the sake of Utah women, because there are many things that flow from unwanted children.
Thank you for the recommendation.
Thank you. I'll see no other business. We will look forward to one final motion, and then see everyone in October.
Motion to adjourn.
Thank you. Motion to adjourn. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned. Thank you very much.